Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Pushkin. Margot Price is no stranger to struggle. In early March, a tornado raged through her home base of Nashville just as she was preparing to release her third album. A month later, as Tennessee residents were ordered to shelter in place to prevent the spread of COVID-19, Margot's husband and longtime collaborator, Jeremy Ivey, tested positive for the coronavirus. While taking care of her sick husband and two young kids, Margot decided to push back the release of her new album. It may seem like a no-brainer, but for Margot, it was a really tough decision. And with her simultaneously not being able to be on the road like she usually is right now, things in her life just feel a bit upside down. But Margot Price is a gifted songwriter who always manages to turn adversity into a great song. In the past, she's written her way through personal devastation like the loss of a family farm and the death of an infant son. Her new album, That's How Rumors Get Started, pulls from that same well. But musically, owes a debt to more carefree rock music like The Stones, Tom Petty, and Fleetwood Mac. In this interview, Margot tells Bruce Headlam how playing an open mic at a Best Western hotel made her a better songwriter. She also talks about hawking her wedding ring to record her first album and how spending a weekend in jail was all the inspiration she needed to refocus her career. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's Bruce Headlam and Margot Price, who connected recently on Zoom.
So you've been at home with your two kids now for 2 months?
Yeah, 66 days. I'm one of the psychopaths still keeping track.
Who's counting?
Well, my son was asking the other day, so I sat down and did the math.
And your husband got sick in the middle of all this, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
Your husband, who's also your co-songwriter and, you know, a great musician.
Yeah, partner in crime.
How is he now?
He is still not fully recovered, but slowly getting better every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a long road. And yeah, I'm just glad that he is not going into the hospital. And we've been able to treat it here. He's been doing like nebulizer treatments, the breathing treatments, and sleeping 12 hours a day, taking a lot of vitamins, drinking a lot of water. Just, there's nothing you can do. So you go into the emergency room and then they're like, yep, we hope you make it. We're just going to send you home now because you're not bad enough to admit and we can't really give you anything. So they gave him like an inhaler and wished him luck.
Yeah. Well, and you've had to postpone releasing your new album, which is what we're here to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have to. I just, everything came on so quickly and I thought, okay, well, we'll be able to tour this summer. So I'm just going to push it back a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I finally came to the realization that, like, no, there's not going to be tours for probably the whole entire year. And so now I'm just focusing on getting it out. But at the beginning of quarantine, we had just been hit by the tornado. Our friend John Prine died and Jeremy got sick, and all those things combined, plus having two small children at home, I couldn't properly release a record. I didn't have any more music videos to put out. I didn't really have any content to work with.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned John Prine, who's, you know, at the head of the list of great musicians who've been lost to this. You know, there's a terrific version online of you doing Unwed Fathers with him. When did you first meet him?
I met John on his 70th birthday at the Ryman, and I was asked to come sing In Spite of Ourselves and Unwed Fathers with him. And it was just really surreal because I'd been a student of his songwriting for decades, and he was so down to earth and so nice and funny and real. I just feel like there's very few people that remain that grounded throughout that kind of success. And he was one of the realest people I ever had the pleasure to meet. Still kind of doesn't seem like he's gone because we're not seeing anybody. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of feel like I'm going to see him down the road, but every once in a while it kind of like clicks that, you know, and you remember it. Yeah. Just such a loss.
Yeah. I mean, you guys, you have the same tendency, I think, particularly in sad songs. You both come up with the kind of perfect image, you know, riding high on low expectations, and why don't you do the math, pay gap, ripping my dollars in half. You know, there are things, you can't turn money back into time, which is a line I just love. Those lines sound like John Prine lines to me. Have you ever sat down and said, yeah, I'm going to write a John Prine song? Or is that just Midwestern sensibility?
Well, that's very high praise. And I thank you for that. I don't think I've come close to his greatest works in any capacity, but I definitely have, you know, studied what he's done. And the thing that I love about John is that he uses his entire vocabulary, and he's not afraid to use quirky, strange words that most people would think were too ugly to put into a song, you know? And my husband and I actually wrote and recorded a couple summers ago an album that we shelved, and it was a psychedelic gospel record. And I think on that album, I was, you know, really trying to mimic his work because we had been on the road with him a lot. And of course, I haven't put that out yet, but there's a couple of like songs that are floating around out there on YouTube. One's called The Devil's in the Details. And I played that acoustic for John, and he told me that he really liked that song. And that was the highest compliment I ever got, really.
You're so good at those kind of lines. I'm just wondering, and what I'm jumping ahead because we'll talk about songwriting more, but do those lines kind of emerge and then you think, that's a great line, I'm going to put that in a song at some point? Are they just things in a notebook that find their way in, or do they emerge while you're writing the song?
Some of them just emerge as I'm writing the song. Can't Turn Money Back to Time, that was something that happened like while I was strumming. And my husband and I were I had written most of the song, and then we talked through a little bit of that chorus, and it just clicked at that point. But I do tend to find lines like that and make a note of them. Or like if somebody in the room says something that's really witty, I'm like, okay, I'm you're not going to write a song about that, and I'll write it down. Like, well, yeah, the album title, That's How Rumors Get Started, that actually was something my guitar player said in the bus when we were drunk one night, and I just was like, I'm taking it.
All right, nice. Actually, that one, now that I'm thinking about it, that line, you can't turn money back into time. What's the line after that?
Take it from me, darling of mine.
Yeah, that's what makes that line, that there's such a shift in the take it from me, darling. That to me is just, you know how everybody remembers the first line of Hallelujah? They say there was a secret chord David played.
Yeah.
What makes it is the second line, which is, but you don't really care about music, do you? Which I think is that.
Oh, I know, I got chills.
People always leave off that. And that just, that's the killer. And when I heard that song, that's what I thought of.
Well, I wanted, you know, I had written Hands of Time long ago. And I remember this woman in North Carolina. She said, she was an old family friend, this old hippie lady. And she was all drunk one night. And she's like, you got to write a song for your other kid. And I said, okay, I will. And so that was me kind of writing like a note to him, like, you know, when I'm gone on the road, but also when I die. And I've been thinking so much of that line as I'm home these last couple months, like, okay, well, here's your time. You know, I'm not bringing in money, but I have time and I'm really trying to enjoy it and savor it.
So I mentioned you and John Prine were both Midwesterners, ended up in Nashville. Where were you born?
I was born in a town called Rock Island, but my folks always lived in Aledo, Illinois. And it's like, you know, west of Chicago is just how I explain it. And the town had 3,700 people in it, and it gets smaller every year, more and more people move away because there's less opportunity and just a really desolate area. I mean, after the 80s farm crisis and how things have kind of continued to go with corporate farms, and it's a great place, but I don't think I could ever live there because it's a hard way of life, I think, for a lot of people.
How did music start then for you?
I think because there was nothing to do, it felt like such a important lifeline in my life. You know, my father always had the oldies station on. And so there was a lot of like classic rock. And he always liked to play the dad game in the car that was like, you know who this is? That's the Beatles. You know who this is? That's Carole King, you know? And he wanted to like school me on, that's Rod Stewart. So it annoyed me and I didn't like that music at first, but then it really started to grow on me.
Was there a particular song or particular moment that it really hit you musically?
I loved Tom Petty songs. I loved, like, you know, American Girl and a lot of those songs. I felt like he was talking directly to me, and he made it seem like it was like okay to be from middle America, like a small town, and be a nobody. He like romanticized it in a way that I really appreciated. And in school, we still had some good programs. Like in fourth and fifth grade, we did like these show choir things that, you know, singing and dancing. And in fourth grade, the theme that year was like country music. And so I got my first little solo to Patsy Cline, Walking After Midnight. And I did, you know, kind of start at that point to enjoy country music more. I wasn't always sold on what was on the radio, but my grandmother, she played a lot of the old stuff for me, like Loretta and Dolly and Johnny Cash. And that was cooler to me than even the 90s country. There's still some 90s country that's like, okay, you know, and now it's like obviously having a big resurgence, but my heart is in across the board, whether it's rock and roll or country music, it's like the 60s and 70s.
Right. Yeah. Now it's always funny to me when people are like, you know, I like the old stars like Garth Brooks. I'm like, Garth Brooks? You know, like, I thought you meant like, you know, Ray Price or Merle Haggard or something, you know.
Exactly.
We'll be back with Margo Price.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With their easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. Visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
We're back with Margo Price.
So when you decided to become a musician, I mean, you could have gone to Los Angeles or New York. You chose Nashville. And why was that?
Well, I wanted to go to Los Angeles and I wanted to go to New York. And I think my parents were just terrified to let me go that far away from them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just being 19 years old and fearless. And, you know, very trustworthy. And I came to visit, I had a cousin living here in Nashville. And she's like, I swear, it's not all, you know, cheesy country music. Because at that time, I just wasn't into a lot of the music being made on, you know, top 40 radio or country radio. I didn't feel like I was going to fit in. But I came on my spring break of my sophomore year of college, and she took me down to like Rock Block, which has like Exit Inn and The End and all these cool like rock clubs, and went to the Springwater and just, you know, lots of grungy dive bars.
Mm-hmm.
That I kind of started like going to these open mics and going to shows at Mercy Lounge and Cannery. And I thought, okay, I could live here. And I dropped out of college and moved here just 2 months after I visited.
Now, how long had you been writing songs by that point?
Well, I started writing just poems and making like a cappella demos when I was, I don't even know, maybe 7 years old or something.
Wow.
And then around that time too, my mom put me into piano lessons. And so I took piano for several years, and then with my eighth grade graduation money, I bought a Japanese guitar, bought a Samet guitar. My parents were like, we really think that you should buy a computer for your schoolwork. And I was like, well, I had my eye on this guitar.
Oh.
And I immediately started learning how to play chords and learning how to play songs, just kind of self-teaching. That was when I really got bit by the bug, I'd say, like 13, 14.
I mean, you did have an uncle who was a songwriter in Nashville.
Yes.
Bobby Fischer, who wrote You Lie for Reba McEntire.
He has written so many songs. He's still writing songs, and he's in his 80s and just sharp as ever. He sent me a song last week that I'm going to try to put some music to if I can find 5 seconds to pick up my guitar. he wrote for George Jones. He wrote for Charlie Pride, Tanya Tucker. He was just really driven and also came from the middle of nowhere and got a start later in life. So it was inspiring to see that. And we'd come down to go to Florida and we'd always stop in Nashville and stay at his house. And I'd like look at his gold records on the wall. And, you know, he had stories about Garth Brooks and stuff then too, because that's who he was hanging out with. It was like Reba and Garth and all the top Nashville cats at the time.
Right. Wow. Did you play your stuff for him?
I did. When I first moved down here, I think, you know, my mom thought it was going to be easy to like connect the dots. Like, oh, you go to your uncle's and you play him your cute songs and he's just going to find you a record label and, you know, manager and plug you in with the right people. And I went over to his house and we went in his writing room and he's like, all right, we'll see what you got. He sits there and I tune up and I played him a song that I wrote. It was called No Love Lost. And I thought it was pretty decent and played him two other songs. And he just sat there in complete silence, stared at me, and he's like, well, this is what you need to do. You need to go to your apartment. You need to get rid of your TV, get rid of your computer, and you just need to sit and just keep writing songs. Just write a song every day, and you'll figure it out. And that tough love like hurt so much because I knew, I mean, he didn't say, well, I like this, but I don't like this. I mean, he basically was just like, just keep trying. So, like I said, I was going to all these like open mic writers' nights, and one that I was going to pretty frequently, I'd go almost every week. It was a Best Western, and there was a bar in there that was called the Hall of Fame Lounge. And there was never really a wait like to play. And there was a lot of good unknown, you know, I didn't know who a lot of these writers were. And I assumed that, you know, not many of them had a lot of cuts because they were just playing in the hotel bar. But I made friends with some of the like older pickers there. And, you know, I was hanging out with like 60-year-olds as a 20-year-old and they'd buy me drinks and kind of would sit and swap stories and I'd get advice. And I was really just studying the crowd's reaction to like everybody who played. Like, okay, well, why did everybody laugh and like clap for this guy, but nobody reacted when, you know, the next person played. And I think at that point, you know, I was just trying to get my head around like, what is a good song? There has to be humor, darkness, a lesson, but not too many cliches. You know, all these things started kind of firing off. And that is where I really began to study, you know, what makes a song good. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in retrospect, your uncle gave you great advice.
Oh, without a doubt.
But it must have hurt at the time.
I cried. I called my mom. I was like, I don't know if I should be here. He said my songs weren't good. She's like, did he say that? I'm like, well, no, but I'm reading between the lines. And he's really proud of me now, though. And he's very complimentary. And he's always sending me different articles and telling me stories. He's got this guitar that just everybody has like tattooed this guitar with. He has like a tattoo gun and you etch your name in it. And the day that he asked me to sign that guitar, I really felt like I'd accomplished something.
Oh, amazing. There are two things I do want to ask you about from your early days, which is, did you really hawk your wedding ring so you could make your first album?
I did.
Wow.
I got it back. At the last minute. But we sold a ton of music gear, a lot of cool microphones and reel-to-reel machine. And of course, my husband sold the car, which I thought he was absolutely nuts for doing. But once he did that, I was like, okay, well, let's just try to get as big of a budget as we can and do this right, because I didn't want to do another Kickstarter. I had done that. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to ask anybody for money. I didn't have anybody I could ask for money. I'd already begged my way out of multiple problems at that point. So there, yeah, that was, seemed like the only option at the time.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is, after you did your first album, you signed with Jack White's company. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? Because you'd gone through a lot of rejection.
Yeah. I sent that album out to probably 50 record labels, but I had this write-up in Rolling Stone. We did a video in a hotel room for Since You Put Me Down, and Rolling Stone wrote it up and they said, sounds like Jack White produced Loretta Lynn. So I always wonder if that's how it got on his radar. But my pedal steel player, Luke Schneider, he told me that Ben Swank was interested in hearing my record. And Ben is, you know, Jack's right-hand man. And so I sent it to him and he was like, oh, this is good. Okay, I'm coming to a show. And he came out to a show at the Basement East. And I heard he was there like afterwards. And I was like, I can't go talk to him. I'm too nervous. I don't want to go talk to him. My friend Amanda was like, no, come on. I know him. He's super nice. He's really down to earth. And I went out there and he was like kind of slurring his speech. And he was just really drunk. He's sober now. He's one of my very best friends. And I'm so grateful that he came out and watched us perform. Liked the record, was very instrumental in everything coming together.
I don't want to talk too much about your early Nashville days, because you've written about it so beautifully. Your first album starts with Hands of Time, which is like a memoir that would take somebody else 300 pages. It takes you 6 minutes. Are all your songs still that autobiographical?
I think this third album that I am putting out here is still autobiographical, but there's other elements of, like, I don't know, that really could be more about anybody else. And some songs have, you know, it's like I wrote them to multiple people, if that makes sense. Like,
Right. That's
how Rumors Get Started is not just to like one of my friends that didn't make it. It's to like multiple friends that are kind of struggling and like caught in their same bad habits. And there, and then there's like I'd Die for You. That's definitely, you know, Jeremy and I's relationship based off of that. Letting Me Down, Jeremy and I, we each wrote a verse, and we wrote to, both of us wrote to different people in our past that we went to high school with.
Oh.
That you know, we had different experiences with both of them, but like his friend was a burnout drug addict who like joined the army, and he wrote it to that friend. And I wrote it to a friend of mine who'd been raped and had a really tough childhood. And so we wrote them towards different people and then worked on the chorus together. So it's each one's different.
We'll be back with more Margot Price.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time, or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With their easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. Visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards, a hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
We're back with the rest of Bruce's conversation with Margot Price.
So you switched labels on this one, right?
Yeah, I had two albums with Third Man. And then for this third one, they're still doing they're pressing the record at their pressing plant in Detroit, which I think is really cool. Yeah, I just had the opportunity to, Loma Vista was like there and ready. And I wanted to get this out actually last spring, but then I got pregnant. So it's just taken a while to get it out. But
did you make the album while you were pregnant then?
Yeah. I started making it in December of 2018.
Mm-hmm. This is going to sound like an odd question, but you've got such a powerful voice. Does being pregnant affect how you sing? Does it affect you physically in a way?
Well, you know, early on when I was in the studio, I was wearing a baggy Fleetwood Mac t-shirt. You couldn't even tell I was pregnant, really. Mm-hmm. But I worked on it for months and months. And as time went on, it did get harder to breathe. I mean, you've got child pushing on your rib cage and your diaphragm. But at the same time, I was being so good to my body. And I was like working out and sleeping, you know, 8-9 hours every night. And I wasn't drinking and I wasn't smoking any weed. And I felt like I had incredible control over my voice, where I was like, oh, I think I gained a few notes up here in my head voice. Mm. So I felt like it benefited me in a way. And I performed just a few nights before I had Ramona. I sang with Mavis Staples. I mean, I was massive, and it was harder to sing at that point, but.
Right. Well, that's not too intimidating, being on the stage with her.
She's so nice though. And she just was like, had her hands on my stomach. She's like, I'm going to be the godmom.
Oh, that's nice.
She's like, I don't have babies anywhere of my own, but I got babies all over the world. I'm a godmother to hundreds of babies. You can name your baby Mavis if you want. So it was incredible to be up there with her. And she was grabbing my arm and helped lead me on stage. Like it was something else. It was her 80th birthday at the Ryman.
And your daughter's middle name is Lynn, isn't it? And that's for
Loretta. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you friends with her?
I am. Was talking to her daughter when Loretta's last album came out. She fell ill. And so they asked me to come up to Ernest Tubb Record Shop and do a little interview and kind of talk about her and sing a song for her. And I was pregnant at the time. I had just found out. I hadn't told anybody. And I was talking to her daughter, Patsy, and I just started kind of picking her brain. I was like, you didn't ever like resent your mom because she was on the road all the time, did you? She's like, oh no, we never knew any other way. Mm. You know, it was just daddy was home and he took care of us and mommy went out and made the money. And sometimes we'd go on tour and it was great. She's like, are you thinking about having another baby? I was like, oh, maybe, I don't know. And a couple of weeks later, Loretta called me and I told her at that point. And she's like, well, I tell you what, you can use Lynn as a middle name. It's a boy or girl name. I give you the blessing and I hope you have, you know, I hope you have five more. She's like, you can do it. I'm like, no, I'm done.
You know, what a lot of fans loved your first couple of records, you had like a kind of pitch perfect 70s Nashville sound. I don't want to confine it just to that, but you had the kind of Telecaster, the bright Telecaster, the pedal steel. You had a great band. So I was a little unprepared for this new album, which first of all starts with this beautiful little piano part by Tom Petty's collaborator, Benmont Kench. First of all, tell me how it came about that you recorded the album the way you did and what you were thinking about when you recorded this album.
Well, obviously, country music, I think it always goes through these kind of resurgences where it becomes really, you know, popular and it becomes fashionable, like both in just what people are wearing, but also in people trying to have that more traditional sound. And once the mainstream Nashville kind of caught on to what the underground was doing, and once they started to mimic that and regurgitate it, I wanted to jump ship. And there's a lot of things about the country music industry that I don't agree with, that I've never agreed with. And I just wanted to try to get away from that. Mm-hmm. The sexism, the racism, and just the overall bullshit politics that comes with it. And it's like you speak out about one thing that they don't like, and then they blacklist you. And then, you know, when you die, like with Merle Haggard or something, they're like, oh, well, we're going to tribute you. Anyway, so I wanted to get out of that. And I wanted to make something completely different because I see a lot of singer-songwriters, a lot of people get into the habit of like making the same album with the same themes like over and over again. And I just didn't want to become stale in what I was doing. And I've always loved rock music just as much as I've loved country. And that's why I think people like Neil Young, Linda Ronstadt, people who skirted the line of both and never were confined to a genre. That's the kind of career that I want to have, something that outlasts like the fad of just a genre.
Mm-hmm. But it's one of those albums that like lots of people do their California album or their different kind of album. But your album, it just doesn't, you can hear influences here or there. I think particularly Letting Me Down, I think the ghost of Tom Petty kind of hovers over that one in a good way.
Yeah. thank you.
But, you know, there's that old line about originality is when people can't figure out your sources or something like that.
I like that.
I kept thinking, oh, I think I know what she's doing. But the sound of it is really quite something.
Thank you.
You know, like Hey Child, I could see a lot of people doing it as a big kind of gospel number. And you sort of go there, but you don't. It's really interesting combination of things. What were you listening to? What were you thinking about?
Well, you definitely said Tom Petty and Heartbreakers, Fleetwood Mac. That was like the kind of the overall thought. And sprinkle in some Bruce Springsteen, maybe the Pretenders. Hey Child, I think, was our most Stones influenced song. And we wrote that song almost maybe 8 to 9 years ago. And we were just super into the Stones. And Sturgill was like, what happened to that Hey Child song you used to play? And I'm like, oh man, I've already recorded that. I don't want to do that song. I don't, you know, feel connected to it. And I had 16 other songs that, and we ended up recording 16 songs, but I was like, all right, you're right. No one's heard it. Let's give it a shot. And, everybody on the session was like, this is a killer song. I really wanted, you know, with the background vocals, I wanted to get that like Mary Clayton, Give Me Shelter kind of like vibe going at the end.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think the fact that like maybe because I am a woman, like doing the Stones, like people aren't like, oh, where is this? It's not like if I was just maybe directly pulling from Emmylou Harris or Loretta Lynn, like I have in the past. I think that's more easy to pinpoint.
Right. Can I ask you about a couple of the songs that I thought were just standouts? And you just mentioned one, Stone Me.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Well, my husband threw me the title. He's like, hey, I had a song title I thought you should write to. And I was like, okay, what is it? He's like, Stone Me. And I was like, okay, I know where you're coming from. And I think he wanted some kind of like Last Dance with Mary Jane or like, let's get to the point, roll another joint, you know, like just like a stoner anthem. And I tried to write it like that and just nothing came out. And then him and I had an argument actually when I was on the road and he called me a bitch. And so I wrote Stone Me and I typed it on my phone in my notes. And I like, it was just a poem and I sent it to him and he's like, oh, that's good. And then he sent back like 2 hours later, he sent back the melody and was singing my words in it.
Wow.
And so he got a co-write on a song that was like about him. Nice. But like I said, you know, with like some of my songs being about two different people, it was like, I started writing it about him and then I deflected my anger towards this like hack journalist that writes like these smear pieces on me. And so it kind of became about this, like this blogger that have a lot of disdain for, but
okay,
yeah, it's a combo song.
Well, I'm not going to say anything bad about you now because I don't want to show up in the next album. And I mentioned Hey Child, which I think is just stunning, and I keep listening to it. Tell me about that one. Where did it come out of?
I mean, around the time that we wrote it, it was after my husband and I had lost our son, and we were hanging out with a couple bands and all of us would play the five spot together in our respective rock and roll bands. There's a band called The Lonely H that had just moved here from Portland. They were a little bit younger than us and we started hanging out with them and like partying a lot. And there's a lot of drugs going around that scene at the time. And so a lot of those lyrics are kind of about how everybody was more or less had like a death wish and just, but it was such a different time because there was something really exciting happening. There were a lot of really good bands and you knew that it wasn't going to last that way forever. We were all partying like we had made it, you know, like we were partying like we were the Rolling Stones, but everybody was like broke and throwing in like $4 for a bottle of like Benchmark whiskey and getting blind drunk probably 4 or 5 nights a week. That's around the time that Hey Child was written.
Okay. You know, you mentioned the loss of your son, Ezra. And, you know, you've had other losses. A lot of your songs are about loss. In fact, even your songs they're about success or about loss, like Twinkle Twinkle or Prisoner of the Highway. Is that kind of the way you see the world?
I'm a glass half empty kind of girl, what can I say? I do try to find the good in the situation. And I found myself recently really trying to keep a positive attitude about, you know, well, something bad in my life, every time something bad happens, something good does always come out of it. But I do like the melancholy, like a sad song in a major key or a major key song with really sad words, like a little pain. It's like a happy song, but I just never like songs that are like all one way or the, you know, just how much is that doggy in the window kind of, or you are my sunshine. That's a good song though.
That's a bit Loretta Lynn and Merle Haggard. That's kind of the way they did it.
It can be in there. Yeah. I mean, it can be sprinkled in there, but I've always found myself attracted to darker lyrics. I mean, I loved Johnny Cash growing up. I loved his attitude. He didn't care what anybody thought. And he had kind of this like chip on his shoulder. And, you know, even after he became successful, he was still singing the song of the working man and of, you know, I mean, the whole story of Man in Black and just people who still carry that burden. I still feel for people that are in a bad situation right now, you know, even though I'm very lucky, I have to remind myself and do what I can to help people that are not as fortunate because I've been there.
Mm-hmm. You know, Johnny Cash wasn't really in Folsom Prison. When you write your songs about your weekend in prison, that's the real thing.
Unfortunately, yeah. I feel like I learned a lot that weekend because I was seeing women that were in there for much longer than me. And when I wrote the verse about the girl who was in the cell with me, she would get up in the morning and I would see all the women line up and get their paper cups and swallow their pills. And, you know, basically she's like, oh, you just should tell them that you were like, are coming off of heroin because then they'll give you pills and you can sleep all the time. And I just had so much compassion for what I saw and, you know, like thought to myself, I can never come back here. I'm not going to find myself back in this position. And so I really did get sober and pull my life back together because I was in a really dark mental space. Like just, you know, I really debated checking myself into a mental institution. I called a friend of mine who had been through AA. She was much older than me. Her name was Royanne. She used to hang out with Towns Van Zandt and sing with him back in the day. And she was sober and she's like, whenever you're ready to quit your rowdy ways, you give me a call and I got a chip for you, you know? And I called her and I was like, I think I'm going to check myself into a mental institution. She's like, don't do it. She's like, they'll have your name forever. It'll be a mark on your record. And you just, if you can work through it, you should. But then of course I went out and I drank and drove my car stupidly. I did try to call a cab, but they never came. And I hit a telephone pole in East Nashville, less than a mile from my house, right in front of two police officers at about 2 a.m. And I tried to outrun the cops because I had weed on me. I had a pipe. I had booze in the car and I'd been drinking for like 6 hours. And I did not obviously outrun them. I eventually pulled over. I thought maybe I could pull into a driveway and turn my lights off. Like maybe I can get all the way home, but they got right up on my ass and I pulled over in front of a Baptist church and walked the line in the rain and failed. And it was humiliating. I mean, I had a young son at home and at that point I just knew I had to quit being a deadbeat and focus on my goal again.
Mm-hmm. So is music still important to kind of keeping you centered and focused?
Oh, without a doubt. I've been feeling more depressed in the past 2 months, as I'm sure everybody in the entire world is feeling. And I've, even before the pandemic hit, I was just kind of feeling like some postpartum depression. And I was really looking forward to getting back out on tour. I thought, you know what? I just need to get back to myself and mm-hmm. get back to my work. And this album's going to come out. Everything's going to be fine. And then when this hit, I just started feeling really hopeless. But I have two kids to take care of. And I get up in the morning and I brush my hair and I fix myself some eggs. And I do typically put a record on because whether it's a sad song that I'm listening to or a happy song, it's just good to have those feelings with music kind of playing in the background. And I feel like I've kind of fallen back in love as a listener, you know, because there's not a lot to do. It's like, oh, I can really fully immerse myself into where the song wants to take me.
And what have you been listening to in particular?
Well, I've been listening to every Bob Dylan song that he's been putting out. I've been listening to the new Lucinda Williams a lot. I adore her. So as far as, you know, new music that's being released, oh, and Fetch the Bolt Cutters by Fiona Apple. I've been a huge fan of hers for a long time. Every day is something different. I'm just trying to, you know, think about starting to write again myself. And I'm going to really throw myself into recording a lot of music because I can't travel and I can't play songs. And I think what's really inspiring about the Fiona Apple record is just that how long she was making that and how, you know, she just focused all of her energy into that. And I think that there's a lot of people that are hopefully writing their true feelings and, you know, getting back to the core of who we are as people.
Mm-hmm. So what's it like to think that there are many, many people out there who are getting through this listening to your music?
That's a good feeling. I think I don't really see myself as that successful. I don't know why, but I feel like I spent so much time like playing dive bars and clubs, and I even wrote about it in Stone Me, you know, I won't forget what it's like to be poor. I could be there again, that's for sure. And then here I am like, okay, there goes my main source of income, touring. And not like, you know, I'm trying to say any poor me thing because I'm doing fine. But I never wanted success to change who I am at the core. And so it is nice, you know, and my husband like reminds me, he's like, you got a lot of people out there that enjoy your gift and it's a gift to both you and them. And, you know, he tries to both, you know, keep me grounded, but also make me realize what I have. And I am grateful that people are listening, and I just can't wait to get this new record out. I just can't wait.
You really are from the Midwest.
Yeah.
I can't enjoy this.
It's true.
Well, listen, thank you so much for doing this. It's been great.
Thank you for asking great questions. That doesn't always happen.
And before we go, we wanted to share a quick interview Bruce did with the Uncle Margo mentioned. Here's legendary country songwriter, Bobby Fischer.
So what was it like in the set when you would go plug songs? What were you doing? You were going around to different labels?
Yeah, wherever you could, you know. I found out just how could you do it? Like, you know, I used to drink beer with a guy that his wife was Conway Twitty's maid. And I'd give him something I wrote, you know. He'd take it and she'd maybe Conway would be doing breakfast. And if it felt right, she would show him the song. Wow. You know, he'd that's terrible or whatever, you know. And I end up with two Conway cuts, you know, just somewhere down the line. And,
yeah.
I mean, when Conway breathes life into a lyric, you really got something, you know.
Yeah.
I had these two guys, great writers, Charlie Black and Austin Roberts. We were playing poker one night, and they said, you know, we ought to work together. We laugh and have such a great time. We're all writers. So they said, you find an artist, and we'll produce them free, write all the songs, and then you take over because we don't want none of the business part. So I said, well, that's great. So I found this artist, and I named her C.C. Chapman. It's a great singer.
Sure.
And so then we wrote all 10 songs. I got her on Curb Records. We put out a couple, you know, Mike Curb, it looked very tight-fisted. He didn't put out much for promotion. And so they called me one day and said, you don't have anything strong enough left in there. You know, we had these singles out, and they're not going anywhere. And I said, oh, man, you should listen to them. And they said, no, let's move on. So anyhow, I was sitting there. I took three of them out, and I went out to Reba McEntire's office. Mm-hmm. Never had met her, but as it turned out, this is how, to me, things happened. Did you turn right or left that day? I come in the lobby. I was going to give them to the secretary, but this kid that I just met at a little party, he was walking through the lobby. I said, would you hand these right to Reba? He said, yeah. So it looked good on him, you know.
Right.
So about a week later, she put two of them on hold, and she cut two of the three, you know.
Wow.
And, down the line, of course, one of them was You Lie, right, that we had written, Chapman, you know. And so then somewhere down, when we went to number one, Curb Records called me and said, I didn't think it was a hit until I seen them selling You Lie t-shirts. So anyhow, that was just pitching. But I mean, if I wouldn't have walked over there and that guy was walking through, you don't have that.
Yeah. Yeah. So far, the secret to your success is you drink beer, you go to parties, and you play poker.
That's pretty well it. Yeah.
The world has changed, you know. I know.
I hate that for people. You know, I've had 702 cuts on my songs.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. So it just, most of them never come out, you know. Yeah. It's just shotgun. And a lot of them, maybe they get a cut and they turn out to be something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still writing. I got 11 songs going right now that I write. So I'm still getting some things done. And it's really fun doing it. If somebody likes your lyric enough, you know, to work with it.
Mm-hmm.
And Margo, Lori and I wrote with her husband and her way back. And right now I've got one with her. I sent her a lyric and she emailed me back. She said she liked it and she's going to work on it.
That's great.
And she has a very good talent. She'll probably come up with some.
Now, she told us the story of when she first went there and played you some songs.
Uh-huh.
Now, what do you remember of that meeting?
I remember you knew that she was talented. I didn't hear, I heard really good songs for what they were.
Mm-hmm.
My thought always was, can we get something in the charts to make some money? You know, because the charts is what it's all about. I didn't hear that, but I heard really great writing, and it sounded like from years ago, what the kind of music that I really liked. And but I thought, you know, you can always grow from that. I mean, she's that good, mm-hmm. and you could always tell there was something there, but there wasn't a lot I could do. And so I wanted to write with her, and we wrote with different, and we tossed stuff back and forth, you know.
Well, she's doing great now.
Yeah. Yeah, oh man, she's doing wonderful. Yeah, well, and then later on, I didn't realize how much other talent she had. She, you know, she did the Opry here quite a while mm-hmm. back, and I mean, she goes over and plays the drums and the piano and everything else.
Pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you another pitch story. My wife and I went to a Cracker Barrel one morning,
mm-hmm.
and so after we got done and we come out, she stayed in looking at the knickknacks. And I went out on the deck there, and this sports headline said this team they got beat, but it said they hit the ground running. And my head said, hit the ground running when your heart gets hurt. And so in about an hour, I wrote, hit the ground running when your heart gets hurt. It's a nice, corny little song, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I got with this Rick Giles, who's a great writer, and he cleaned it up. He added a Cajun yodel to it, and then he was able to do a demo. Didn't cost us nothing. He could put that picking on there and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I would have the demo. It's my job then to go try to get it cut for us, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was down on Music Row there, and I ran into Bud Logan. He's a great producer, musician. And he was producing John Conley, and I'd read where there was going to be a project for the new Opryland Records.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into Bud Logan. I know he's a real cut and dry guy. He don't want to hear anything to waste your time.
Yeah.
And I ran into him. I was pitching cassettes, you know. And I said, Bud, I hear you doing John Conley for Opryland. He said, yes, I am. And I said, I got four songs I'd like to see you. He said, come over two. You know, like, mm-hmm. and so two, I go over with my four songs. Just him and I in the office, and I hand him the first one. He listened like all the way through. I thought, well, he must like it, you know. He said, a lot of talk about nothing. And so I handed him the next one. He said, next one he listened through. He said, yeah, like not for John. I handed him the third one. He said, yeah, I like it. Yeah. But, not. And so I handed him Hit the Ground Running, the demo that I had gotten. And halfway through, he said, that'll be John's new single on Opryland Records.
Wow.
And that's just how he did, you know.
First of all, how did you find Garth Brooks to do your demos, or how did he find you?
I was writing with another guy. There was three of us writing, and he said, next time you do some demos, you ought to use this guy that I'm writing with and maybe use him on a demo sometime. His name is Garth Brooks. And so I said, I'll have to try to line up with him. Well, I never did line up with him to write. But anyhow, then another guy named Charlie Quillen and I wrote couple of songs. So we just hired him just because this Kent Lacy had told us to try him. And yeah, and he come in, and you know what I remember about him? And he was in recording in the booth with that big cowboy hat on. Mm-hmm. And so we're just in the control room, just me and him and the engineer. He's in there singing, and we stopped everything. We're talking something over. He's looking like worried in there. He comes in, and he took his hat off and stood in front of us. He said, "I'll sing this over as many times as you guys want me to." And I said, "No, it's not, you know, we're just studying it." And so, yeah, but that's how he is still, I think, you know.
Can you, tell he was going to be a star, or did he impress you then?
I don't think exactly. I mean, because when you're down here, you hear so many great talents. They could all make it, you know.
Yeah.
You look at the ones that are not very good that have made it. It's just, you know, there's lots, so many more that are great talent that didn't make it.
What's that? Then what do you think separates? Is it, as you said, just luck?
Luck.
People who make it, people who don't?
Luck, yeah. And, you know, and then it gets down to maybe it's a great voice, but did you get the right song? Did Kenny Rogers get The Gambler right at the right time? Or, you know, mm-hmm. The Gambler had been cut like a couple of times before Kenny ever got it.
Right.
But it was that production. So there that entered into it, was the right production that he had around it. You know, mm-hmm. Larry Butler produced those.
I don't know how people plug songs. Like,
yeah.
You must have been very sure of yourself and very optimistic that you could do that.
I was sure of the songs, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many names you're familiar with in country music, but, you know, I've had maybe four Roy Clark cuts. And
I know Roy Clark.
Yeah. Two Lee Greenwoods, mm-hmm. two Rebas, two Charlie Prides. I mean, just names that you think I would have sit back and think, oh, man, if they'd just say hello to me. You know,
yeah. You had Farron Young, didn't you? You've had a lot of.
I had a couple of Farron Youngs, and what a nut he was.
Was he a nut?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Egotistical, but fun. Him and I got thrown out of place one time, which was our own fault. But yeah, he was always getting in trouble. Yeah, and here's another thing. I got. I guess you can't see it. This here. I'm gonna try to hold this up.
Is this the guitar?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and then here's the back.
So this is all, what do you use like an etching tool and put their names in it?
Yeah, it's like one of them, like a dentist thing, you know.
Yeah.
I started out with an ice pick where you had to try to scratch in your hand. It killed your hand finally, but trying to get it in there, you know. And so I bought one of those little engravers. So now everybody can put them in. Anyhow, so let's see, I was going to tell you. 260 names. On the guitar. And I mean, it's names that are just, you know, Chet Atkins is on there.
Yeah.
Garth Brooks got God Bless You, Bobby on there, and just on and on. Just
wow.
Greatest names. And a lot of people you'll never hear of, you know.
Mm-hmm. I heard Margo Price is on there.
Margo's on there. Jeremy, your husband, is on there. You bet.
Fabulous.
Glad to have him on there.
Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, good to talk to you. I just appreciate you guys so much doing that.
Thanks to Margo Price for taking the time to chat. Make sure to look for her new album when it drops, and you can check out all of our favorite Margo Price songs by heading to brokenrecordpodcast.com. Also, be sure to check out our YouTube channel. You can subscribe at youtube.com/brokenrecordpodcast. Broken Record is produced with help from Jason Gambrell, Mila Bell, Leah Rose, and Martin Gonzalez for Pushkin Industries. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond. Thanks for listening.
Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora. To inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today. The tradition of breaking tradition continues with the return of the Unconventional Awards from T-Mobile for Business at Mobile World Congress. This is an event that celebrates innovators whose bold actions took their industries to new places. If that sounds like you and you're a T-Mobile for Business customer, enter today. If you win, you'll be publicly honored among some of the most influential leaders in industry. And me, I'll be there too. Enter now at T-Mobile.com/unconventional awards. See you there.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.